I think in the U.S. you have a game where you play cops and thieves, right? Where you chase each other and you try to entrap each other and, right? You play that game?
Oh, yeah. Cops and robbers.
Cops and robbers, yeah. So we used to play cops and Pablo Escobar.
Marginalia. Notes in the margin of a book.
Notes, commentary, and similar material written in the margin of a book.
Comments and notes which are incidental
or additional to
the main topic in the margin of a book.
Although Fruit of the Drunken Tree is fiction, it has its roots in author Ingrid Rojas Contreras' real life. You see, Rojas Contreras was born in Bogota, Colombia, and lived there until her early teens. Her mother liked to help girls who were in less than fortunate circumstances, and one of those girls was threatened by guerrilla fighters to act against the author's family. That girl and that situation was the inspiration for Ingrid Rojas Contreras' debut novel, Fruit of the Drunken Tree. I spoke with her on the book's publication day about her life, the novel, and so much more. I'm Beth Golay, this is Marginalia, and here's our conversation. To set this up, Fruit of the Drunken Tree is set primarily in Colombia in the late 80s and early 90s. Pablo Escobar is at the height of his career as a narco-terrorist. There are factions of guerrillas throughout Colombia, and many citizens are being kidnapped and ransomed. Now, the novel focuses on two particular families, the Santiagos and the Sanchezes. And Alma and Antonio Santiago, who have two young daughters, Chula and Cassandra, have hired a maid, Patrona Sanchez. And I understand that although the book is fiction, it was inspired by your own life?
Yeah, that's right. I grew up in Bogota, and I lived there until I was 14 years old. And during that time, my mother, who grew up, she came from a poor family. She was always interested in helping out girls that she saw were stuck in just different situations throughout Colombia. There were some girls who had been displaced, internally displaced in the country from the violence, or maybe their parents were ill and they were, you know, very young, but the only member of the family who was able to work. And so we always took in many, many young women into our homes, and they lived with us and they became part of our lives. And so one of the girls that Petrona is based on fell into this situation where she was threatened by the guerrillas to act against our family. And that moment and that event is kind of the inspiration behind the book.
Now, you wrote the book from two perspectives, chapters that, for the most part, alternate between Chula's voice and Patrona's voice. What was that writing process like? Did one voice come more easily than the other?
You know, they were so different to write. Chula is a very happy child, and then because she's surrounded by violence, then her happiness is a little bit strange, or the things that she enjoys and the games that she plays become a little strange. And that was very fun to write. And she's also a very curious child. And Petrona, who is 15, so her point of view is a little bit older and more nuanced, and she understands more about what's happening. Writing her chapters, I think, took a lot out of me emotionally, and just trying to imagine her fully and trying to get to a voice that sounded like what I envisioned in my head.
You know, you mentioned Chula being a happy child, but kind of having some strange games that she would play. There was a section in the book where Chula and Cassandra are playing Barbies with Petrona, and all of the Barbies were missing limbs because Cassandra liked to chew them off. But in their playful imaginations, the girls told stories of how each Barbie became a paraplegic due to guerrilla warfare. Now, I know the book was inspired by your own life, but was there any reality based in that scene?
There wasn't, no, but I, you know, as an adult, when I would go back to Colombia and I would visit with my little cousins, and it's just that thing where you watch kids play and suddenly you're taken back to your own childhood. And I remembered how, I think in the U.S. you have a game where you play cops and thieves, right, where you chase each other and you try to entrap each other, and right, you play that game?
Oh, yeah, cops and robbers.
Cops and Robbers, yeah. So we used to play cops and Pablo Escobar, you know. So some of us would be the cops trying to apprehend Pablo Escobar and his cronies. And then the other group would be Pablo Escobar and his gang. And we all fought. We all wanted to be Pablo Escobar because it was obviously the one with the most power. So it reminded me one visit when I was in Colombia and I was watching the games that my little cousins were playing. And I was living in the States by then. And it came at me as such a stark difference between how children grow up when they're surrounded by violence and how there is still the joy of childhood and everything has that patina of fun. But because it's Colombia, then there's always something dark running underneath, and children completely pick up on that. So that scene where the girls are playing with dismembered Barbies, when I was thinking of, you know, what is the one toy that all girls have, and I was thinking of just a parallel, just making a parallel of something that I knew was true to life, that kids bring in what they see around them into their make-believe.
Now, in the book, the girls were at a rally where Luis Carlos Galan was assassinated, and then they came away traumatized but with no bodily harm. And then they were safe when their abuela and two cousins were caught in guerrilla crossfire when they were going to get some water. And Chula started to feel guilty that nothing bad was happening to her. And even though she's young at the beginning of the book, 7 years old, I think, she seems to be an old soul. She had the insight to realize that when both Patrona and Abuela had been out of it, she found it astonishing how much nicer the things they imagined were compared to the real suffering of their bodies. You know, between this and the gorilla Barbies and searching for lost souls at night, she has a bit of a morbid streak, doesn't she?
Yeah, it's true. One of the things that I like to think about is how Colombian humor is different than the American humor. And often, I think when you're surrounded by explosions and by car bombs and kidnappings, and very often terrible things, if they're not happening to you at the time in the 90s in Colombia, they were happening to someone you knew. So I think at the time, kidnappings were as common as it would happen to every 1 in 5 people. So it was extremely common practice. And if you had family that lived anywhere that wasn't Bogota, then it was very probable that they would have been near a crossfire or that they would have been near a car bomb that had gone off. So I think one of the things that has completely inspired me about Colombians is that even though that is the reality, Colombians are still very joyful, and they try their best and they succeed in finding joy wherever they can. So to me, Chula's sense of humor is a mirror of that. And maybe if it's a little strange, it's because it emerges from the dark circumstance.
There's one section in the book where, when addressed, Chula and Cassandra's abuela would respond with the same 4 proverbs in a muted voice. And she said, "We shall eat more and we shall eat less. When at dinner you have fire, for breakfast you'll have water. What is left for time, time will take away. And it is only death that doesn't have a remedy." Is there a story behind these proverbs? Are they authentic proverbs, or did they come from your imagination?
They are authentic proverbs. And I just have been so in love with proverbs ever since I started to write in English. And it was writing in English was one of the first times that I realized that we have these sayings in which our deepest cultural outlook are embedded into these sayings. And so it only became obvious to me because I encountered them in English, and they were so foreign to me, and they were the first time that I heard them. And I thought they said so much about how a country of people think that it made me curious to go back and look up what our Colombian proverbs were. So I found this wonderful book of proverbs. And in writing the book, I was just reading through them just to try to get the voice of Colombia as as a culture. And so those four proverbs are ones that I underlined and kept coming back to and kept thinking about. And then next thing I knew, they came up in the manuscript.
When did you start writing in English?
I started writing in English the year that my family and I left Colombia. And we went to Venezuela. And I think there was something about being in a new place that made me want to write in English. I had lost all my friends. I was 14. I was in this new place where I didn't know anybody. And so I turned to my notebook to soothe myself and to give myself solace. And I started to write in English, I think initially because my parents couldn't understand it. So it was a secret language that I had for myself. And then it started to, as I got older and started to think about it and continued to write in English, writing short stories, I thought that it was the perfect language for an immigrant to express themselves in, just because when you're an immigrant, you become a mixture of things. And so it made sense that my language would also be one that wasn't my own and one that I constantly try to bring Spanish into.
Do you still write in Spanish?
I write in Spanish whenever I am surrounded by the language for a prolonged amount of time. So I was in Colombia and I did a 4-month research trip. And I think at the 2nd month mark, I started to just write in Spanish.
Do you ever read a book in English and again, the same book in Spanish and come away with different books?
I've done that repeatedly with Gabriel Garcia Marquez's 100 Years of Solitude. I've read it in Spanish, and then I read the translation in English. And that is the best translation of a book that I've ever read. I can read both of them. In fact, I did. I opened both of them to the same page and just looked over the one and looked over the other. And it doesn't happen often, but it's such a good translation. So I do love seeing that, and I do love reading books in one language and then another. The nuances are different, and there are some things that are of course, untranslatable. So those are fun to see, and I, you know, conceptually love to think about what is left behind by language or what kind of concepts cannot even make it into another language.
We have a reading challenge going on here. It's the second year that our local paper, at the beginning of the year, they challenged people with like 12 categories and just trying to get them out of their comfort zone and to read something they wouldn't normally read. And one of the categories this year is to read a book that was published the year you were born. And for me, it's 100 Years of Solitude. I've started it, and then I had to put it aside because I have so many books that I have to read for work, and I don't know if I'm going to get back to it, but that makes me smile to know that it's a really good translation, so I look forward to getting back to that one.
Yes, and Gabriel Garcia Marquez even said that the translation bettered the original.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
So, you know, it seems lately that so many of the books that I read are timely. A book about a survivor of sexual assault, which happens to be published during the Me Too movement, or this book about a family eventually seeking asylum in the United States is released during a time when current asylum seekers fleeing violence are being turned away or separated from loved ones at the borders. And the publishing of these books, you know, I'm sure it's been slated for years. They're not being rushed to print. Do you think these books are timely, or is it that our social issues are timeless?
That's a great question. I think a little bit of both. I think there are writers who are eternally preoccupied with one subject. I have always been preoccupied with the plight of immigrants and asylum seekers, and I think it came out in the writing. Just when you write a book, all your joys and all your curiosities and your sense of humor and all your preoccupations come out into the words that you write. And I think immigration is going to be something that is going to preoccupy and take our attention. So, yeah, I wrote the book. I had a draft as early as 2008. And then I abandoned it, and then I worked on it again. So I've been working on it for many, many years. And as an immigrant myself and becoming American and getting to know how immigrants are treated and how there are even degrees in what is a good immigrant and what is a bad immigrant, you start to see how different aspects are leveled against different communities of people. And you start to see the injustice in that. So it naturally, when I turn to write, I want to solve those nuances through storytelling and just offer a story that, to me, encapsulates all those issues.
Now, I understand you write book reviews and conduct author interviews for The Spine, a biweekly column for KQED in San Francisco. Today is publication day for Fruit of the Drunken Tree. Do you think your work and criticism has helped or hindered you in preparation for today?
You know, I've seen so many authors go through this day, and, you know, I never imagined myself in their shoes. So I'm thankful that I didn't do that because I didn't have a preconception of what today might be like. And it's just been great. I mean, social media has been so great for people of color and, you know, women and writers, and we just have such a great community. And I have writer friends online that I only know online, and we get very excited about each other and things happening for each other, and we support each other in every way that we can. So it's been really great. I've just been waking up and just seeing messages on my feed, and yeah, just feeling the love. So I don't think I ever imagined or thought about what it would actually be like. But I did watch a lot of writers go through it.
Now, we have talked about a lot. Is there anything that you'd like to talk about that I haven't asked?
I think this part is interesting. When I was composing the book, you know, we talked earlier about being in between languages and choosing English as the one that I focused on and that I live in. Mm-hmm. When I was writing this book, I think I saw something on CNN and became, you know, consciously aware or artistically interested in the CNN interpreters who are hearing another language and they are simultaneously speaking in English, interpreting it. So the next time that I sat down, I tried to do that. So I was, in the writing of this book, I did a lot of this mentally where I was thinking in Spanish and hearing the story in Spanish and hearing all the dialogue, everything in Spanish, and then typing it in English so that I was translating what I was seeing and hearing.
You know, there's another author I interviewed from Bogota, Juan Gabriel Vazquez. Mm-hmm. Are you familiar?
Yes, I love his writing.
Well, I talked to him about something very similar because, you know, his work that I was going on about had been translated to English. And so I asked him how it felt to have me talk about these words, you know, that affected me so much, have them not even be the words that he wrote. It's kind of crazy how translation works like that, isn't it?
What did he say?
He said, "That's fascinating, isn't it?" And then he rolled his R's. No, he just, and he also has served as a translator for books from English to Spanish. And I can't recall everything that he said, but it was kind of a remarkable thing that we were talking about his words that really weren't even really his words.
Yeah, so Fruit of the Drunken Tree is translated into Spanish, and it's coming out in October. So I got to see the Spanish translation, and looking at the language in Spanish just hurt my brain.
I think really?
Because I had initially thought of the novel in Spanish and then did this strange process where it came out in English, to see the novel in Spanish was like hearing myself speak in my head before the words actualized. So it took me a long time to be able to to get over that strange brain feeling. But it's a beautiful translation, And yes, there were times when I felt like the translator had completely read my mind.
So it was pretty close. It was pretty close to how you had, you know, conjured it up in your brain before you translated it. So it was pretty close to that.
Yeah, it was very close. The translator was from Mexico. So there were some parts where I just was able to go in and recommend a more Colombian way of saying things. But there were passages that were completely close to what I had thought initially.
Well, congratulations. It really is a fantastic book, and I hope you enjoy the rest of this publication day.
Oh, well, thank you so much.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
All right.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
That was Ingrid Rojas Contreras, author of Fruit of the Drunken Tree, which was published by Doubleday. Thanks for joining us for Marginalia. Discover new episodes at KMUW.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Marginalia is produced at KMUW Wichita. Our engineers are Mark Stasser and Torin Anderson. Our editors are Louie Ann Stevens and Haley Crowthen. And I am the producer. This is Marginalia. And for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.